Welcome to Writers on Writing with Barbara DeMarco Barrett on KUCI 88.9 FM in Orange County, California at KUCI.org.
Writers on Writing features
authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and the business of writing. And stay with us till the end. We have a wonderful show today with T. Jefferson Parker. And at the end of the show,
around 5 to 5,
I'll announce this week's ticket giveaway, so do stay tuned. As I said, today my guest is T. Jefferson Parker. He was born in L.A. and has lived all of his life in Southern California.
His seven novels, Laguna Heat,
Little Saigon, Pacific Beat, Summer of Fear, The Sugarman's Dance, The Blue Hour, the bestseller Where Serpents Lie, and his latest, Red Light, are all set up in the area in which he grew up.
Parker was educated in public schools
in Orange County and took a bachelor's degree in English from the University of California, Irvine, in 1976. It's right here. He was honored in 1992 as the Distinguished Alumnus. His writing career began in 1978 as a cub reporter on the weekly newspaper, the Newport Ensign.
After covering police, city hall, and cultural stories for the Ensign, Parker moved on to the Daily Pilot newspaper, where he won 3 Orange County Press Club Awards for his articles. All the while, he was tucking away stories and information that he would use in his first book, Laguna Heat.
Jeff Parker is an occasional contributor to the L.A. Times Book Review and the L.A. Times Magazine, and for 3 years wrote a weekly column for the Los Angeles Times Orange County edition called Parker's Place. He currently lives with his wife and 2 sons in Southern California. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Barbara.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm fine. Welcome back to the show.
Well, good to be here.
Yeah, I found Red Light just a wonderful book, a wonderful read, and much different from your last book in that the evil, the destructive forces are so much more subtle, and there's so little violence, virtually no gore, and yet just so wonderfully suspenseful. Was this a conscious decision?
Yeah. I set out to write a book that would be suspenseful and kind of a mind game with the reader, and to write a kind of a classic whodunit in the sense that you don't really know the who or the why or the end of the book. And that was a much different task than I had set for myself with the Blue Hour, which is kind of the first part of this story.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah. Did you know when you were writing the Blue Hour that you were going to be doing a sequel?
No, I didn't. When I finished that book up, I thought it would be interesting to follow Mercy Rayborn, the woman who becomes the protagonist of the Blue Hour, if you will. And about the time I finished that book, I started thinking along the lines of a sequel, because it seemed to me like she was a character who I could write about again with some interest.
Well, she's just such a wonderfully tough woman. She says what she thinks. She cares little if people like her. How did you come up with her character?
Oh, I don't know. It's kind of hard to say. I think in a lot of ways, I tend to write characters that are different from me, who are different from me, and maybe kind of do things that I would like to do in life, but I don't. And one of the things that I admire about Mercy is just what you said. She says what's on her mind, and she doesn't pull punches, and she's pretty blunt, and she's very honest, and I like that about her. And I think what's interesting about her, beyond that, just a little bit, is the fact that she's also very ambitious. And she wants to be a successful deputy, and she has this timeline whereby she's trying to accomplish certain things. And she actually seriously wants to be the sheriff of Orange County someday, and she thinks that she can do that. So on the one hand, you have this woman who kind of says what's on her mind and can be easily offensive to people. Yet on the other hand, she's trying to track this kind of high political road with regards to her career, and I think that makes for a nice kind of a conflict within her character.
Mm-hmm. As well as she has a fatal flaw and is certainly not perfect and many times doesn't like herself very much. When you're coming up with, and all of your characters actually in all of your books seem to seem to be like this, that there are no perfect main characters. Now, when you're coming up with your protagonists, are you thinking about this too? Are you thinking, now what can I give this one? What can I do with this one to really imperfect him or her?
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, nobody has ever accused me of writing a, square-jawed, Boy Scout heroes or Girl Scout heroes, certainly. You know, they all have their flaws and their problems. And I think, when all is said and done, it's the flaws and the problems that make characters interesting. You know, it's not so much what they can do right. It's the temptation to see what they can do wrong and what their pitfalls are. And that's, I think, when a character becomes interesting is when you pit a character with weaknesses against the situation in which those weaknesses are going to be exploited. Then you have a wonderful tension between what that character wants to accomplish and what he or she is going to be able to actually get done during the course of the scene.
Mm-hmm. When you first started out writing, did you know this, or did it take some time and experience to realize that perfect characters and are not what we want to read?
Well, I think you evolve a little bit as you get older, and maybe you're more prone to pointing out the weaknesses or the foibles in your characters. My very first hero, I can remember 15 years ago, Tom Shepard in mm-hmm. Laguna Heat. He was really kind of a Boy Scout in a lot of ways, and yet he drank a little, and he was a chain smoker, and he had a broken heart, and kind of the standard things that you attach to characters to gain sympathy and to show their flaws. Since then, my characters, I think, have a little bit less obvious problems and a little less obvious pitfalls waiting for them, and I think that's more true to life. I think when you look at people on the street and you get to know people, you find out what their weaknesses are later rather than sooner. And so I think as an author, you kind of grow into that, and you can present then a character who on the surface from the first few scenes may seem to be kind of normal and kind of with it and have their act together. And then as the book goes on, you see it's like a tennis opponent wearing down another. You see the story start to wear on the character, and you realize that character is not fully equipped to deal with the problems that are going to arise during the course of the book, and that's what makes a story interesting, I think, one of the things.
Mm-hmm. Names as well, Mercy Rayborn. It's an interesting name.
Yeah, it is. I cast her name against type because she's not a particularly merciful mm-hmm. character, and there's a brief line in The Blue Hour, I think, about how much she hates to be called No Mercy, mm-hmm. but that's the obvious nickname that people come up with for her, so I cast against type a little bit on that.
Was it difficult to write a woman character? Well, this is the second book, so I'm sure if it was, it's no longer, but what is that like?
Well, it's hard, yeah. It's one of the reasons I wanted to write a female protagonist was because it seemed like a good challenge to me, so I tried it. I wanted to write I wanted to see if I could write a woman who was believable and credible and likable, more or less, and would be a good protagonist for the story. It's hard to write about women for men, I think, and it's hard for men to write about women. And I think when you read fiction, especially mystery crime fiction, you run across a lot of female characters written by guys that sound like female characters written by guys. And you run across a lot of male characters written by women who sound like male characters written by women. And there's just this funny kind of one side of the fence or the other that you see often in fiction. And I wanted to try to see if I could actually walk on the top of that fence rather than fall on either side. So, it was one of those little challenges that you put before yourself as a writer. And it's one of the things that's high on your list of things to accomplish, even though when the reader goes to read it, the reader's not thinking that at all. The reader's thinking, am I going to get a good story? Can I hack this character for 400 pages? And I'm thinking, well, how am I going to write a woman character? So I'm getting good comments on Mercy. I mean, people seem to like her. They like her brashness. They like her the ambition that I mentioned earlier. They like her kind of straight shooting. And I think people also, what they like about Mercy, which is what I like about Mercy, is the fact that Mercy doesn't really complain. You know, Mercy holds her emotions pretty tight, you know. She's not going to tell you all of her problems. She keeps a lot inside. She's not a complainer. She's not a whiner. She kind of takes her lumps. And I think people admire that in a character. I know I do.
Mm-hmm. It's difficult to pull off. And you pulled it off. She's a great character.
Well, I like her. I think she's fun. And something you mentioned a few minutes ago is another thing that I like about Mercy, and that is Mercy is a really capable woman, and she's bright, and she's ambitious, and she has a good heart. She's fair, generally speaking, and she's a lot of good things. She's moderately attractive. You know, she's a big, strong specimen, and all this. But Mercy really has kind of a low self-image. She has low self-esteem. And I'm a fan of low self-esteem. I think it's a wonderful trademark in a person. You know, when I go to make a friend, give me a guy with low self-esteem. You know, I like him. And I think that's neat about her. She doesn't think that she is the greatest thing since copper wire. And so I like that.
Yeah, and you get the feeling as you go through this book and the other that others think she's much more attractive and appealing than she ever will.
Yeah.
And that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think humility is a nice characteristic.
Yes.
And the bluff that so many of us need to cover it up, which she does.
You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM. My guest is T. Jefferson Parker, author of Red Light. Will you read to us?
Oh, I'd be happy to. Yeah.
I must also say while you're preparing that the cover to this book is gorgeous. The metallic red on the black. It's just really a beautiful cover.
Yeah, I think they did a nice job on this. It's a good looking package. They actually took a picture of me on the back that makes me look pretty good. Okay, Barbara, I got the prologue here.
Okay.
No place to start like the beginning. And this is about 3 pages. And I guess it really needs no introduction because, where you begin with the book. You ready?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, here goes. Prologue. You might not have liked Aubrey Whittaker. She acted superior. She walked as if she were the most beautiful woman on earth, which she wasn't. She didn't say very much. But she was tall, but she wore heels anyway. And if she finally did say something, you felt like a driver getting a ticket. Her eyes were blue and infinitely disappointed in you. She was 19. She let him come to her place again that night, something that had happened only once before, strictly against policy. But he was different than the rest, different in ways that mattered. In her life, she had learned to read men who were as easy to understand as street signs. Caution, yield, stop. But did you ever really know one? Aubrey had chosen a small black dress, hose with a seam up the back, heels with ankle straps, and a string of pearls. No wig, just her regular hair, which was blonde and cut short, sticking up like a boy's. The lipstick was apple red. She made him dinner. She could only cook one thing, so she cooked it. And a salad, rolls from the bakery, a pot of the good French roast coffee he liked, a dessert. Flowers in a squat, round, crystal vase that had cost a lot of money. They sat across from each other at the small table. Aubrey gave D.C. the seat with a view of the Pacific. D.C. was the abbreviation for dark cloud, the nickname she'd invented to capture his pessimism about human nature. It was an ironic nickname, too, because D.C. wasn't dark to look at, but light, with a broad, tanned face, a neat mustache, sharp eyes, and a chunk of heavy blonde hair that fell over his forehead like a schoolboy. He was quick to smile, although it was usually a nervous smile. He was taller than her by a good 3 inches, and strong as a horse, she could tell. He told stupid jokes. She told him he could hang his gun on the chair, but he left it holstered tight against his left side, farther around his back than in the movies, the handle pointing out. Whatever, she thought. The idea of safety pleased her, made her feel compliant in a genuine way. Aubrey Whittaker rarely allowed herself a genuine feeling, couldn't always tell them from the ones she portrayed. They talked. His eyes rarely strayed from her face, and they were always eager to get back. Hungry eyes. When dinner was over, he sat there a moment, wiping the silverware with his napkin. He was fastidious. Then he left at exactly the time he told her he'd leave. "Off to see a man about a dog," he said, another of their little jokes. At the door, she put her arms around him and hugged him lightly, setting her chin against the top of his shoulder, leaning her head against his ear for just a moment. She could feel the tension coming off him, like the heat off a highway. She thought that the kind of guy she wanted would be a lot like D.C. Then she straightened and smiled and shut the door behind him. It was only 10 minutes after 10. She flipped on the kitchen TV to an evangelist, put the dishes in the sink, and ran water over them. She watched a car roll out of the parking lot below, brake lights at the speed bump. It might have been D.C.'s big, serious four-door, or it might not have been. Aubrey felt warm inside, like all her blood had heated up a couple of degrees, like she was just out of a hot bath or had just drank a big glass of red wine. She shook her head, and smile lines appeared at the edges of her apple-red lips. "It's just unbelievable, girl," she thought, "what you've done with your life. 19 going on 100. You finally find a guy you can halfway stand. He trembles when you touch him through his clothes, and you let him drive away." She rinsed the dishes, dried her hands, and worked in some lotion. The fragrance was of lavender. Through the window, she saw the black ocean and the pale sand and the white rush where the water broadened onto the beach, then receded. In the middle of the living room, Aubrey stood and looked out at the water and the night. Thinking of the different shades of black, she pried off her high heels, then got down on all fours. Balance. She could smell the lavender. From there, she was eye level to the arm of the black leather sofa. Tentatively, she placed her left hand out. Tentatively, she raised her right knee and slid it forward. Then the hard part, the transfer of weight to the other hand, in the moment of peril as the left knee came up to support her. She wavered just a little, but when her left leg settled beneath her, she was okay and very focused because she had to repeat the whole complex procedure again. Her doctor friend, the shrink, had advised her to do this. She had never learned. She had walked at 11 months. Her doctor friend had said that for an adult to develop fully, to form certain concepts, especially mathematical ones, she needed to know how to crawl. Then Aubrey heard a knock at the door. A flash of embarrassment went through her as she realized what she was, a 6-foot woman in a short black dress crawling across her living room through the scent of lavender. She sprung up and walked over. "Who's there?" "Just me again, Aubrey." It was a little hard to hear with all the cars roaring by on Coast Highway. "Your dark cloud." She flipped the outside light switch and looked through the peephole. The bug bulb must have finally burned out because all she saw was one corner of the apartment building across the alley, laced with Christmas lights, and the tiny headlights out on Coast Highway, miniaturized in a fisheye lens clouded with moisture. She hadn't replaced that bulb in months. When she opened the door, she was smiling, because she half expected his return, because she knew he was in her control now, and because she was happy. Then her smile died from the inside out, and she formed her last thought. No.
Thank you.
That's prologue.
Yes, it is the prologue. And if you've just tuned in, that was T. Jefferson Parker reading from Red Light, published by Hyperion. After I finished the book, I really wanted to go back and start over. And that's a wonderful thing.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
Because
I'm glad you liked it.
You really want to track all the little foreshadowing elements and see it more clearly, see them more clearly, perhaps. You, more than just about any suspense writer I know, write literary mysteries, or what I consider literary mysteries. Do you think of yourself in that way?
Well, yeah. In my secret heart, I think I'm a literary mystery writer. We all tell ourselves that. But yeah, I try to. I try to bring you know, as high a level as of literary skill and concern to a book as I'm capable. That's always been high on my list of things to do. You know, I want to write a book that's interesting and fun and is a page-turner and is mysterious and is suspenseful and has good characters and kind of all the things that you'd want to do. But I always want to try to make it as high a literary, you know, line as I can make, because I grew up on literature. I read a lot when I was a kid, and I studied literature in college, and to me, literature is one of the, you know, the three or four sacred things in life.
Hmm. So when you were reading and writing, starting out, how did you know that this was a genre that would that was for you that you could stay interested in and write book after book?
Well, you know, I didn't, Barbara. I kind of came to mystery suspense writing by kind of accident. It was a long accident, but it was still an accident. So I didn't really see myself as any specific kind of writer. When I got out of college, I wrote a book and I sent it off to an editor I knew in New York, and he read the manuscript and called me up a few weeks later, and he said, you know, this is a pretty decent book, but I don't think anybody would really be interested in reading it, and we don't want to publish it, and I don't think anybody else would publish it, but you're a pretty good writer. Why don't you try to write something that's a little more appealing to a wide range of people, something a little more commercial. And the book that I had given him, the manuscript I had sent him, was a small kind of personal Bildungsroman about a young guy growing up in Newport Beach and learning about his father. A Search for a Father is what that book is about. And it's very small and kind of quiet and what have you. And it was a very literary first novel, if you will, typical young person novel in a lot of ways, I think. And so when he said that to me, he said, you know, you got skill and you got some talent. Why don't you try to write something a little more commercial, a little more appealing? I was just at that time reading Chandler, and I was just at that time reading John D. MacDonald and Dashiell Hammett, some of the more hard-boiled guys who I had not had a chance to read in college because I was reading Joyce. And I was reading these guys, and I thought, you know something? I admire their craftsmanship so much and their plots so much. They're so complicated, and yet they finally make sense at the end. And human nature takes on this kind of kaleidoscopic feeling, and you never quite know if what you're seeing is real in the book or not. I admired that kind of ledger domain so much that I decided to try to write a mystery on the theory that there was an audience out there for mystery. So that's a long answer to a simple question. After I wrote my first mystery, which became Laguna Heat, the book did well, and so I wrote another one and another one and another one, and I'm still writing.
Do you ever long to write a literary novel again without the mystery element?
Sometimes I think that. Yeah, sometimes I think that. At this point, I don't know if I'd know how to do it. Because to be honest with you, I really like the I like most of the conventions of the suspense and mystery novel. I like them. I like the fact that you know when you pick up a mystery suspense novel that life and death is what it's about. You know, somebody might die. There's going to be a dark side to human nature, and it's not going to be all about people at their best, and it's not going to be sort of a talkative little exploration about the innermost, you know, workings of some everyday character's soul.
Mm-hmm.
You get something a little bigger. You get something a little more dramatic, I think, and I like that. I like death, and I like revenge, and I like betrayal, and I like adultery, and I like all the things that I write about, because I think they have a high octane rating for me, for a reader. You know, it's like, let's get in and really see what's making these characters tick and what they're going to do, and I love that about mystery. So if I were to sit down and write, you know, my most literary novel at this point, it might not be a mystery, but I'll tell you, it would be precise, and it would be dark, and it would end in death.
Interesting. Well, on that note, we're going to take a break. Don't go away. I'll be back with T. Jefferson Parker, author of Red Light. Stay tuned.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. Go. Come back, baby, let's
My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Welcome back to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today I'm with T. Jefferson Parker, author of Red Light, published by Hyperion. Jeff, in Red Light, there is such a great balance between all the aspects of fiction that keep a reader turning the page, the dialogue, the interior, backstory. Gee, I could go on.
Please do.
But how much of this comes naturally, and how much do you attribute to just hard work and revision and years of writing and putting out books that succeed?
Well, you know, that's a tough question. When I wrote Red Light, I wasn't completely enthused about it. I was writing it because I thought it was a good story, and I thought it would be a good sequel to The Blue Hour, and I started writing it because it seemed, for some reason, like I kind of had to. It just seemed like the book to write. So I started writing it, and I outlined the plot and what have you, and I wrote the book in kind of a, I don't know, what would you say it, a workmanlike mood, I think I was in. And when I finished the book, I thought, God, you know, am I going to get clobbered by my readers for this book because it's too conventional and too predictable, maybe, too much like, you know, the other mysteries or suspense that they might read. And the critics liked the book. The people seemed to like it. You know, it sold way better than my other books. And as I go through the book now, like I'm, you know, when I was looking for little passages to read and stuff, and I was reading through it, I think the level of execution is really pretty good in this book. I think it's well written. And I read a passage here and I go, wow, that's pretty darn good. I don't remember writing that. And so I guess that's a long way of saying I think you know, the years pile up, and if you keep applying yourself to your job, whatever it might be, you're just going to get a little bit better at it. And mm-hmm. I think this is a book by a person who is in the process of becoming a fairly skilled writer.
Hmm. What do you hear from readers, and how do you hear from readers? Do your readers have a certain favorite of your books?
You know, there's no predominant favorite. I'm always surprised when people tell me their favorite book of mine. And there seems to be no camp of resounding victory on that. You know, a lot of people like Laguna Heat, a lot of people like The Blue Hour, whatever, you know, even books that I've been, you know, kind of blasted by the critics for. A lot of people tell me that's their favorite book, you know, so who knows?
Do you have a favorite? Or is it always the one you're working on?
Well, it's the one I'm working on, for sure. That's my favorite. I think the one that I'm working on right now is going to be my best one, but I always think that. I will confess to that. I do love them all as a father or a mother would love their different children, because you love them all the same, but they're all very, very different, and you love them for their differences. That aside, I think my favorite book that I've written is probably The Blue Hour. I think that packs the highest emotional wallop. If you can take the somewhat dark passages in that book, and you can abide by the fact that you, the reader, spend time with the antagonist, with the monster of that book. If you can read a book like that, I think it delivers a lot. So that's kind of a personal favorite of mine.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of personal stuff in your books, and you know, things that you've gone through, and I wonder how you do that without I don't know, becoming sentimental or having the writing become sentimental. Do you know what I'm saying? It's just when a writer takes personal elements or difficult times and turns it into fiction, there's the danger of writing it perhaps too sentimental.
Yeah.
And how do you work with that? Is that ever? Do you just let enough time go by so that you can take things in and create fiction out of them?
Well, you know, I sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. You know, and to I think it's kind of an instinct call for a writer. You know, I'm going to sit down and write a very personal book now, and I'm going to do it this way. I think this voice and this story and these events will reflect what I'd like to say, and I'm just going to hope that it comes out well. For instance, when my first wife got cancer and was dying, I wrote about that very directly in a very loud, personal kind of confessional book called Summer of Fear.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still writing about that today. That's one of the elements in Red Light, and yet it's handled in a very, very different way. So I think you really kind of have to trust your instincts and say that, you know, I'm going to try to write about this honestly, and I'm going to try to be restrained about it, and I hope that the story that I tell will move people in the way that I was moved. But you're right. You know, it's very easy to get over emotional and sentimental or whatever you might be about things that happen to you directly especially when they're powerful things. And I guess that's maybe the mark of a good writer who can take those things and make the reader feel the right amount but not ask too much.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM. My guest is T. Jefferson Parker. Yeah. Also, there has to be that. I mean, good writing, good writers also seem to be willing to allow themselves to go to that place, that dangerous place, that sad place, the heartbroken place, and work with it. And others, perhaps, that are not as strong writers, just want to close it all out, don't want to put that into their work, don't want to have to dwell on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting thing. Most of your books are in the third person point of view, and point of view is one of those things that new writers grapple with. Why have you chosen third person?
Well, for this book, for Red Light, I just thought it was the right way to go, you know. I alternate. You know, I've written, I think two books in the first person now, and the one that I'm working on now will be three. So I'm kind of alternating between third and first, and it's for me, it's just been a matter of totally of caprice, Barbara. I mean, it's really just sort of mood. You know, when I get done writing a third-person tale, and I partake in all the joys that telling a third-person tale can give you, I kind of think, wow, I want to do something different now. I want to write a first-person tale and try that. And then when I'm done with that, I go, now I want to go try a third-person tale again. So I just kind of ping-pong back and forth. You know, both of them are powerful tools. Both have their rewards and their joys and their challenges and their Achilles heels, I think. But they're both wonderful to work in and really very different. And I think that it gives the writer a nice kind of inhale, exhale when you can write a book that's one way and then step back and write one that's another way and keep kind of a metabolism going. It seems to help me anyway.
Mm-hmm. Your characters, where do they come from? Do you create composite characters out of people you've known? Does anyone ever recognize parts of themselves in any of your books? And if so, what happens?
Well, yeah, you know, I do both. You know, I some of my characters I create along the lines of people I know. You know, when my father finished The Blue Hour, he said, well, yeah, I recognize a couple of I recognized a little bit of myself in old Hess, Jeff, you know, and of course I had patterned Hess on Dad very, very specifically, you know, and made no secret about it. Others you invent and you cobble together out of characteristics of people that you've met, and you put them in the book because you need them to have those characteristics. And these are kind of minor characters, maybe, you know, the supporting cast. As far as the big characters go, it's mainly an invention, really, you know, and you'll pull on yourself, and I'll pull on, you know, the people I know and my family and my friends and my enemies and whatever, and I'll try to draw the characteristics out of them that are applicable to the book that I'm writing. And like most writers, I'm, you know, fairly shameless about what I'll use. I mean, I would never use a person's name or hurt a living person purposefully in one of my books, but I will steal their personalities and their body shapes and their tics and their speech patterns if it's something that I need.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Some who may not know your work from the beginning or your evolution as a writer may not know that your first novel, Laguna Heat, was many years in the making, and you rewrote it a bunch of times, and it seems like enough work went into that book to discourage any but the hardiest of writer. And I'm sure we've talked about it before on the air, but can you say a few words about that? What propelled you on through that time? And was it something like 6 or 7 years?
It was 5. It took me about 5 years to write that book. Yeah, and that's a long haul. That was 6 or 7 drafts. That was a lot of drafts. I wrote a lot of drafts of that book. But, you know, basically I enjoyed that time, Barbara. I didn't get discouraged because I thought it was going to be a good book when I was finally finished with it. And I thought that I could do it. And the reason that I thought that I could do it was, I think, simply because I was young and dumb and stubborn. And that's all it took. And so I stuck with it. And I kept telling myself that this book was going to be good when I was finished. And it took a long time, but I enjoyed that time. I was working as a newspaper reporter for part of that time. And then the last couple of years, I was working as a technical editor in Irvine on a defense project. But those years for me were kind of freewheeling, low obligation years. You know, I wasn't doing much besides working and writing. And so I wrote in the afternoons when I got home from work, or the evenings, and I wrote on the weekends. And those were nice years. They were nice because there were no pressures. I didn't really know if I would fail or succeed, but just the act of doing it was delightful. And I could see that I was, as the drafts went on, I could see that I was getting a little bit better, and that I would, you know, hopefully get there someday. And when I finally sent the manuscript off to this agent who was recommended to me by Donald Stanwood, I really didn't know what sort of a response I would get. I thought the book was about as good as it was going to get. I didn't think I could make it any better. I'd written it 6 or 7 times. I didn't know anything about the marketplace. I had no idea whether mysteries were in or out or whatever. I just kind of blindly threw it out there, and I was really kind of opinionless at that point about how good the book was. And it's a nice way to be. It was fun. It was interesting. And if I could say anything to people out there who are, you know, doing likewise or writing their first book, is my biggest piece of advice would be to enjoy it. You know, because that first book is wonderful. You only write one of them, and yeah, it's long and it's hard and there's lots of mistakes and whatever. But you know what a nice thing to be doing. You know, it's writing a book it ought to be fun.
Yeah, and if it isn't fun, maybe a writer needs to look at what they're writing about or why they're writing.
Absolutely, yeah. Take up the clarinet, you know, go fishing, whatever, you know. It should be fun. I think, you know, a lot of writers are great for self-dramatization and talking about the woes of their job and how lonely it is and all that kind of stuff. But really, I think if you got to the core of most writers, at least the ones that I know, that they all enjoy it. And that's why there's so much good writing out there and always has been. And that's why when you're in the business of writing like I am, that's why the competition is always so fierce, you know, because I'm in the same marketplace as Elizabeth George and Michael Connelly and Robert Craze and James Ellroy, all of whom love writing books, you know. And so when you when you're up against a bunch of people who love what they're doing, competition's ferocious.
Mm-hmm. But somebody has to do it.
Yeah.
You mentioned the A word a few minutes ago, agents. Have your experiences been good ones with agents?
Yeah, I've had good agents. You know, I've had good agents. I've always had good agents. My kink as a businessman is that when things don't go my way, I fire my agent. So I've had like three of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy that I'm with now, I really like, and I'll probably stay with him, you know, till I finally keel over. But in the past few years, you know, I always look around for someone to blame, and when things aren't going good, most people fire their publishers. I fire my agent. That's just my kink. But I've had good ones, you know, and I think a good agent is one who's attentive to your needs and knows what you're trying to do, pays attention to your career and helps you along, and yet isn't completely fascistic about what you write and what you don't. You know, I kind of cringe when I hear young writers sending their manuscripts off to agents and agents coming back with, you know, thousands of pages of notes and demands for rewrites and changing this and changing that. I always kind of cringe and think that, you know, the agent ought to just back off a little bit. I've never had an agent like that. I've always had agents who are pretty much believing in what I'm doing, and I appreciate it. You need that. It's a good thing to have. You need an ally.
What about editors?
Same thing. You know, if you've got an editor who believes in what you're trying to do, then he or she can help you bring it out. And if you've got one that just wants to fashion, you know, the next whatever out of you, we're going to turn Parker into the next Tom Clancy, or we're going to turn Parker into the next whatever, that's dangerous. And I haven't had anybody like that. I think I've been really fortunate in my career because I've written eight novels now, eight mystery suspense books, whatever you want to call them. They've all been very different. I've never had pressure from publishers to write the same character again. I've never had pressure to, you know, set your books in Washington, D.C., where there's tons of action, rather than in Little Orange County where nothing goes on. They never tell me that. They let me write what I want to write, and I've had really fine editors. I thank them all.
Hmm. How much of the story do you know before you begin? Red Light. Did you have it so totally plotted out and or have the high points at least known so that you could write to them and the ending without saying a word about it? Do you know what it is before you begin?
Yeah, this one I did, Barbara. You know, I've worked both ways. I've started novels not really knowing how they're going to end, and I've written novels based on very detailed outlines. And this I based on a very detailed outline. I think that outline was, 60 or 70 pages long, single-spaced, and it was highly detailed. And I think that helped me when I got stuck a couple times in Red Light. I was kind of thinking, oh, gee, you know, now what? And sure enough, I'd pull down the outline and look at it, and I would read what the outline told me I was supposed to be doing, and it saved me a couple times. It actually worked.
Hmm.
Yeah. On the other hand, though, and you always hear this from writers who are trying to explain what they know ahead of time and what they don't. On the other hand, if you have nothing in the world is worse than having a bad outline. You know what I mean? Because you come to rely on it, and it's your parachute, or it's your skeleton, or your structure, or whatever you want to call it. And if that outline is not working, and you follow it, guess what?
Mm-hmm.
So, got to watch it.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest is T. Jefferson Parker. So how long did the outline take? How much do you work on it?
A couple of months to write that outline.
And you fiddle with it until you're pretty clear this is it?
Yeah, that's right. You can shove things around on that line
mm-hmm.
easier than you can the manuscript.
So then when you do your draft, your first draft, second draft, what sort of revision then do you go through? Or on Red Light, for instance.
Red Light was came out pretty close to the way you read it right now. I didn't do a lot of a revision on that. I think because I had the outline, and I didn't make any big missteps. I didn't make any big errors when I wrote that first draft. So when it came out, it was, you know, we edited it, and we went through it, and changed a few things. And the editor was real good with it, but she had a pretty light hand on it. She liked the way it came to her, and that's pretty much the way we left it.
Hmm. Interesting. One thing I notice among new writers is the desire to err on the subtle side. They're afraid of telling too much about a character or giving too much information. They want to keep the reader in a little, in some sort of suspense, or just not give the reader enough. How do you know when your character is solidly on the page, or you've given the reader enough information but not too much without sort of going way over the top?
Yeah, you're talking about character now as opposed to plot and story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, I think with character, for me, the litmus test for character is really kind of right there on the page in front of me. You know, if I write a sentence that says something that I don't believe, or a sentence that is not believable, then it just can't stay. For instance, I'm describing Mercy Rayburn, and I say something like, Mercy Rayburn had always believed in the best in people. Well, if you look at that and you think about that, you realize that really nobody does for very long. And she's a 36-year-old homicide investigator. That sentence really can't describe her. So I think when you're talking about character, you try to get as close as you can to the general truth of that character's life. And as soon as you say something that's not believable, then it's got to go back out. And what you're left with, I would think, would be a pretty good description of that person's character.
Hmm. What about story? Now, often with writers, at least with my students, I say err on the side of going over the top or being outrageous, because it will probably take you closer to what you want to be doing, what you want to be writing, versus keeping it all in and being a little fearful of saying too much.
Yeah, that's probably good advice, I would think, you know, especially when you're starting off. Yeah, I remember when I began, you know, I thought that, you know, nuance and subtlety was kind of everything, you know, because I just read James Joyce's Dubliners for the 15th mm-hmm. time in a row. But, you know, really, when it comes to making up a story that people are interested in reading, you have a tremendous amount of latitude. And I think oftentimes a large, fat, bold, over-the-top story like you're talking about can really be a lot of fun to read. I think that's one of the things that people look for in books like thrillers. You know, you want a big, over-the-top kind of story. And so I think that can be good advice. Making up a story is hard to do, and whether it's a subtle, quiet little story or a great big cartoon of a story, getting the elements right so that people are interested and moved by the story is the hard part.
What about titles? How important are titles?
They're probably fairly important from the marketer's point of view, you know. You definitely don't want a title on your book that's going to put people off. You want an inviting title. And what is an inviting title? Then everybody's got their own opinion. You know, I've gone round and round with my publishers on titles and book covers and that kind of thing. And they're saying, well, you know, this cover and this title that we want it's more inviting and it's more interesting and more people are going to like it. And then I say, no. I mean, my title and my discovered idea that I've got is going to be, it's going to be those things for completely different reasons, you know. So, you know, publishers and writers are trying to get the same thing accomplished with book covers and titles, I think. But, you know, how you get there is open for debate.
Was Red Light always called Red Light?
No, we went around and around on that. We kind of settled on Red Light. You know, it was something that my editor proposed and sort of liked, and I thought it was, you know, tolerable. And I never really thought it was the best title for a book that I ever heard, but we couldn't come up with anything better, so it ended up being Red Light. And it ties in, you know, because Aubrey, the woman who is murdered in the first scene, is a prostitute, and there's a lot of sexual information in the book, you know, and it's a sexually charged novel in a lot of ways. It's, I mean, it's not like graphic, you know, porno or anything, but you know, sex is an important part of it, part of the motivations for the things that happen in the book. And so Red Light kind of, you know, suggests the Red Light District and what mm-hmm. have you, and it seemed to work okay.
And it kind of works with the Blue Hour.
Yeah, it rings right off the
yeah,
bat, too.
Yeah, rings right off. Will we see Mercy Rayburn again in a future book?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'll write about her again.
Not right away.
Well, the one I'm finishing up now is doesn't have Mercy in it. It's a completely different kind of book. But I think I'll come back to her again. People seem to like her, and I kind of want to see if she can ever make the sheriff of Orange County.
Yeah, I'd like that.
My fans, my readers, came up to me a lot after this book, and they'd read, you know, two books with Mercy in it now. And they said, "Well, when are you going to write a book when Mercy Rayburn gets to smile? When are you going to write a book where Mercy gets a decent boyfriend? You know, when are you going to?" I mean, like, people are all matchmakers at heart. I think, you know, they want to connect up your poor unconnected hero or heroine with a like soul and give them children and dogs or something. I guess.
That's right. We're at the end of our time, Jeff. Any last words, any advice, words of wisdom, anything you can enlighten our listeners with?
Well, you know me, Barbara. I never have any words of wisdom. I just got words. I will say it's nice talking to you, and your questions are interesting and good as ever, and it's really a pleasure to talk to someone who loves writing.
Thanks so much for being on. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Okay. Bye-bye. That was T. Jefferson Parker, author of Red Light, published by Hyperion. And if you have any comments or questions, email me through my website at writersonwriting.com or directly at writersonwriting@aol.com. As for ticket giveaways, I have Comedy Outlaw tickets at the Galaxy for next Thursday, August 17th, and 3 pair of Dream Theater tickets on August 20th at the House of Blues. Email me at writersonwriting@aol.com if you're interested. Well, that's it. I'll leave you with something Aesop said. Please all and you please none. Please all and you please none. Good advice. This is 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and thank you for listening.